Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 676, Sedition, Part 2, Target America. This program is being recorded on June 14th of the year 2009. We spent almost all of Side 1 reading from a stunning op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, of all papers, which basically advocates breaking up America into a number of smaller countries and doing something very similar to other large countries as well. This is a stratagem that we've been exploring for several years now in conjunction with the UNPO and various secessionist movements in the United States, white supremacist and otherwise. I refer listeners to those many broadcasts, For the Record 550, 652, the Going Native series, and others. It was a stunning piece, and as I noted in the course of Side 1, it will enable large corporations to basically rule the world, and it would leave these smaller entities largely to the mercy of the elements as well. Also, don't expect Social Security or pensions from any sort of government job you might have held or the military or whatever, because there won't be any more U.S., and I think that's exactly what they want. By way of sort of getting back into the issue of destroying America by way of paving the way for a globalized version of the corporate state, note, as I've said so many times in conjunction with the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that the German core corporations are run by the Underground Reich, and whereas our corporations are basically pretty much like prostitutes. They whore themselves to whoever can pay the price. The German corporations work like the divisions of an army. In the early part of this decade, when Mannesmann, formerly a heavy industrial company gone into telecommunications, was bought out in a hostile buyout by a British firm, other German corporations rallied around that. You don't see that in the United States. One of the people whose, quote, wisdom, unquote, was cited by the author of that stunning op-ed piece, again, an op-ed piece, a long one in the Wall Street Journal, basically advocating the breakup of the United States. One of the people cited was a woman named Loon, L-U-H-N, a former Reagan White House staffer or National Security Council staffer. It should not be surprising to see somebody of that ilk. Again, the Reagan administration was, in my considered opinion, a front for the Underground Reich, as is the GOP. It's an entire branch of the Republican Party with its roots firmly mired in the Third Reich. And I've talked about Helena von Damm, who picked the lists of personnel from the Reagan administration. She's a protege of Otto von Bolschwing. We're going to review very briefly one of her top assistants from the website of the National Alliance. It's an interview they had a shortwave radio show called American Dissident Voices. It used to be hosted by a guy named Kevin Strom. He got busted on some sort of kiddie porn charge, I think. I don't know what the disposition of the case was ultimately, but he interviewed Bob Whitaker on July 3rd, 2004, and Strom asks him, "So you're a Reagan administration appointee. What's the story behind that?" Bob Whitaker: "I was special assistant to the director of the Office of Personnel Management in charge of security clearances, staffing, and that sort of thing." It's a stunning thing. Again, "I was special assistant to the director of the Office of Personnel Management in charge of security clearances, staffing, and that sort of thing." That from Bob Whitaker. And by the way, one of the many, many myths that a lot of people hold about neo-Nazis and Nazi fascist elements is that they're a bunch of rednecks wearing Confederate flag belt buckles with beer bellies hanging over them. Not true at all. Bob Whitaker's a highly intelligent fellow and a very accomplished one. I don't agree with his views, but he is no dummy at all. He's an extremely bright guy. And he was basically, it would appear, there for assistant to Helena von Damm. And the roots of these things, the seeds that were planted in the Reagan White House, are sprouting all over. As I'm speaking on June 14th of 2009, one of the stories dominating the news this past week was James von Brunn, an elderly fellow who shot up the Holocaust Museum, killing a guard, from the Fox News website. An article, Holocaust Museum shooting suspect had been growing more hateful and desperate. This from Thursday, June 11th of 2009. Skipping down, Todd Blodgett, a former White House aide to President Ronald Reagan, who later became affiliated with extremist groups, said he spent a lot of time with Von Braun in the 1990s and early 2000s. Von Braun is obsessed with Jewish people, Blodgett told the Post. He had equal contempt for both Jews and blacks, but if he had to pick one group to wipe out, he'd always say it would be Jews. Von Braun went so far as to say he fought on the wrong side of World War II, according to Blodgett. Blodgett, by the way, for a while headed up Resistance Records, a Nazi skinhead music label, did that for the Liberty Lobby. Later, Resistance Records was bought out by the National Alliance. And an associate of the National Alliance is Bob Whitaker, who helped to vet security clearances for the Reagan White House. So it's not surprising to see people like the redoubtable Ms. Loon coming from the Reagan White House. But again, if you take all of the large countries and break them up, there will be no power capable of resisting major multinational corporate power, and that's kind of the idea. One of the books published by National Vanguard Books, in addition to Turner Diaries, is, of course, Serpent's Walk. That's a book that we've dealt with at considerable length over the years on For the Record. Reading now from Serpent's Walk, from the back cover, the book assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. And there is a passage that talks about what is intended. And again, I've talked about this book. It's not really a novel. It's really more of a manifesto, sort of a blueprint for what the Underground Reich intends to do. And there is a conversation here between a guy named Wrench, who's an Underground Reich operative, and a mercenary named Lessing, who ultimately becomes Führer of the United States after the U.S. is destroyed by a series of terrorist attacks involving weapons of mass destruction. Martial law is declared. Eventually, the Nazis, who've infiltrated the military, take over. And Wrench tells Lessing, the SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realized that the world is heading towards a corporocracy. 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. And that is the blueprint for the future. We're going to jump now, and I'm going to read a short excerpt from the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens. And that book, by the way, is available for download for free on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And in that book, and in that description for that book, there's an excerpt in which Dorothy Thompson, who was an American journalist and investigative reporter, she wrote for, among other publications, the New York Herald Tribune. On May 31st, 1940, she had the following to say. This is May 31st of 1940, about what the Germans had in mind if they won World War II. Ms. Thompson, writing on 5/31/1940 in the New York Herald Tribune, wrote, "The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essential details of that plan. I've heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica. The Germans count upon political power following economic power, and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations. No nation will have control of its own financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the United States is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the United States to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they've established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. And, of course, among their primary contacts in this country were the Bush family. And, indeed, as the Third Reich was preparing to go underground and the plans for the post-war underground Reich economy and the Bormann capital network were being laid at the August 10th, 1944 meeting in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine, SS General Dr. Scheid cited, among other companies, the Hamburg America line as one that has proved useful to Germany, and he gave New York addresses to the assembled men. The Hamburg America line, of course, one of the Bush family's Nazi businesses. What I'm going to do for the bulk of the rest of this side of the broadcast is to read an article that is reprinted in its entirety in, for the record, 671. That's Update on the Meltdown, Part 4, Germany, the Underground Reich, and the Global Financial Crisis. And again, in many broadcasts, I've talked about the plans for German world domination formulated by pan-German theoretician Friedrich Liest in the 19th century, who envisioned a German-dominated Central European Economic Union as a vehicle for world control by Germany. It was pre-Third Reich. The Third Reich put that into effect, and basically, I don't think it takes much of a stretch at all to see the European Union and European Monetary Union as a shade of things to come. And again, I've spoken about that in the past. For those people who think, well, there goes Dave again, talking out his neck or whatever, just, you know, pure BS, check out the following. This from the Daily Mail. That is a British paper. This was authored by Adam Labor, and this was published by the Daily Mail online on May 9th of 2009. It's titled, Revealed, the secret report that shows how the Nazis planned a Fourth Reich in the European Union. It reads, the paper is aged and fragile, the typewritten letters slowly fading. But U.S. military intelligence report EWPA 128 is as chilling now as the day it was written in November of 1944. The document, also known as the Red House Report, is a detailed account of a secret meeting at the Maison Rouge Hotel in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. There, Nazi officials ordered an elite group of German industrialists to plan for Germany's post-war recovery, prepare for the Nazis' return to power, and work for a strong German empire. In other words, the Fourth Reich. The three-page, closely typed report marked secret, copied to British officials and sent by air pouch to Cordell Hull, the U.S. Secretary of State, detailed how the industrialists were to work with the Nazi Party to rebuild Germany's economy by sending money through Switzerland. They would set up a network of secret front companies abroad. They would wait until conditions were right, and then they would take over Germany again. The industrialists included representatives of Volkswagen, Krupp, and Messerschmitt. Officials from the Navy and Ministry of Armaments were also at the meeting, and with incredible foresight, they decided together that the Fourth German Reich, unlike its predecessor, would be an economic rather than a military empire, but not just German. The Red House Report, which was unearthed from U.S. intelligence files, was the inspiration for my thriller, The Budapest Protocol. by the way, parenthetically. You can read it almost in its entirety in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free on my website. Continuing. The book opens in 1944 as the Red Army advances on the besieged city. This is his book, The Budapest Protocol, then jumps to the present day during the election campaign for the first president of Europe. The European Union superstate is revealed as a front for a sinister conspiracy, one rooted in the last days of the Second World War. But as I researched and wrote the novel, I realized that some of the Red House report had become fact. Nazi Germany did export massive amounts of capital through neutral countries. German businesses did set up a network of front companies abroad. The German economy did soon recover after 1945. The Third Reich was defeated militarily, but powerful Nazi-era bankers, industrialists, and civil servants, reborn as Democrats, soon prospered in the new West Germany. There, they worked for a new cause, European economic and political integration. Is it possible that the Fourth Reich those Nazi industrialists foresaw has in some part at least come to pass? The Red House report was written by a French spy who was at the meeting in Strasbourg in 1944, and it paints an extraordinary picture. The industrialists gathered at the Maison Rouge Hotel waited expectantly as SS Obergruppenführer Dr. Scheid began the meeting. Scheid held one of the highest ranks in the SS, equivalent to lieutenant general. He cut an imposing figure in his tailored gray-green uniform and high peaked cap with silver braiding. Guards were posted outside, and the room had been searched for microphones. There was a sharp intake of breath as he began to speak. German industry must realize that the war cannot be won, he declared. It must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, unquote. Such defeatist talk was treasonous, enough to earn a visit to the Gestapo cellars, followed by a one-way trip to a concentration camp. But Scheid had been given special license to speak the truth. The future of the Reich was at stake. He ordered the industrialists to, quote, make contacts and alliances with foreign firms, but this must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. The industrialists were to borrow substantial sums from foreign countries after the war. They were especially to exploit the finances of those German firms that had already been used as fronts for economic penetration abroad, said Scheid, citing the American partners of the steel giant Krupp as well as Zeiss, Leica, and the Hamburg America Line Shipping Company, parenthetically one of the Bush family Nazi businesses. Continuing. But as most of the industrialists left the meeting, a handful were beckoned into another, smaller meeting presided over by Dr. Busse of the Armaments Ministry. There were secrets to be shared with the elite of the elite. Busse explained how even though the Nazi Party had informed the industrialists that the war was lost, resistance against the Allies would continue until a guarantee of German unity could be obtained. He then laid out the secret three-stage strategy for the Fourth Reich. In stage one, the industrialists were to prepare themselves to finance the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground as a maquis, unquote, using the term for the French resistance. Stage two would see the government allocating large sums to German industrialists to establish a, quote, secure post-war foundation in foreign countries, unquote, while again quoting, existing financial reserves must be placed at the disposal of the party so that a strong German empire can be created after the defeat. In stage three, German businesses would set up a sleeper network of agents abroad through front companies, which were to be covers for military research and intelligence until the Nazis returned to power. The existence of these is to be known only by very few people in each industry and by chiefs of the Nazi Party, Busse announced. Each office will have a liaison agent within the party. As soon as the party becomes strong enough to reestablish its control over Germany, the industrialists will be paid for their effort and cooperation by concessions and orders, unquote. The exported funds were to be channeled through two banks in Zurich or via agencies in Switzerland, which bought property in Switzerland for German concerns for a 5% commission. The Nazis had been covertly sending funds through neutral countries for years. Swiss banks, in particular the Swiss National Bank, accepted gold looted from the treasuries of Nazi-occupied countries. They accepted assets and property titles taken from Jewish businessmen in Germany and occupied countries, and supplied the foreign currency that the Nazis needed to buy vital war materials. Swiss economic collaboration with the Nazis had been closely monitored by Allied intelligence. The Red House Report's author notes, previously, exports of capital by German industrialists to neutral countries had to be accomplished rather surreptitiously and by means of special influence. Now, the Nazi Party stands behind the industrialists and urges them to save themselves by getting funds outside Germany and at the same time advance the party's plans for its post-war operations. The order to export foreign capital was technically illegal in Nazi Germany, but by the summer of 1944, the law did not matter. More than 2 months after D-Day, the Nazis were being squeezed by the Allies from the West and the Soviets from the East. Hitler had been badly wounded in an assassination attempt. The Nazi leadership was nervous, fractious, and quarreling. During the war years, the SS had built up a gigantic economic empire based on plunder and murder, and they planned to keep it. A meeting such as that at the Maison Rouge would need the protection of the SS, according to Dr. Adam Tooze of Cambridge University, author of Wages of Destruction, The Making and Breaking of the Nazi Economy. He says, by 1944, any discussion of post-war planning was banned. It was extremely dangerous to do that in public, but the SS was thinking in the long term. If you are trying to establish a workable coalition after the war, the only safe place to do it is under the auspices of the apparatus of terror, unquote. Shrewd leaders such as Otto Ollendorf were already thinking ahead. As commander of Einsatzgruppe D, which operated on the Eastern Front between 1941 and 1942, Ollendorf was responsible for the murder of 90,000 men, women, and children. A highly educated, intelligent lawyer and economist, Ollendorf showed great concern for the psychological welfare of his extermination squad's gunmen. He ordered that several of them should fire simultaneously at their victims so as to avoid any feelings of personal responsibility. By the winter of 1943, he was transferred to the Ministry of Economics. Ollendorf's ostensible job was focusing on export trade, but his real priority was preserving the SS's massive pan-European economic empire for after Germany's defeat. Ollendorf, who was later hanged at Nuremberg, took particular interest in the work of a German economist called Ludwig Erhard. Erhard had written a lengthy manuscript on the transition to a post-war economy after Germany's defeat. This was dangerous, especially as his name had been mentioned in connection with resistance groups. But Ollendorf, who was also chief of the SD, the Nazi Domestic Security Service, protected Erhard as he agreed with his views on establishing the post-war German economy. Ollendorf himself was protected by Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the SS. Ollendorf and Erhard feared a bout of hyperinflation such as the one that had destroyed the German economy in the 20s. Such a catastrophe would render the SS's economic empire almost worthless. The two men agreed that the post-war priority was rapid monetary stabilization through a stable currency unit, but they realized this would have to be enforced by a friendly occupying power, as no post-war German state would have enough legitimacy to introduce a currency that would have any value. That unit would become the Deutschmark, which was introduced in 1948. It was an astonishing success, and it kick-started the German economy. With a stable currency, Germany was once again an attractive trading partner. The German industrial conglomerates could rapidly rebuild their economic empires across Europe. War had been extraordinarily profitable for the German economy, and by 1948, despite 6 years of conflict, Allied bombing, and post-war reparations payments, the capital stock of assets such as equipment and buildings was larger than in 1936, thanks mainly to the armaments boom. Erhard pondered how German industry could expand its reach across the shattered European continent. The answer was through supranationalism, the voluntary surrender of national sovereignty to an international body. Germany and France were the drivers behind the European Coal and Steel Community, or ECSC, the precursor to the European Union. The ECSC was the first supranational organization established in April of 1951 by six European states. It created a common market for coal and steel, which it regulated. This set a vital precedent for the steady erosion of national sovereignty, a process that continues to this day. But before the common market could be set up, the Nazi industrialists had to be pardoned and Nazi bankers and officials reintegrated. In 1957, John J. McCloy, the American High Commissioner for Germany, issued an amnesty for industrialists convicted of crimes. The two most powerful Nazi industrialists, Alfred Krupp of Krupp Industries, and Friedrich Fleck, whose Fleck Group eventually owned a 40% stake in Daimler-Benz, were released from prison after serving barely 3 years. Krupp and Fleck had been central figures in the Nazi economy. Their companies used slave laborers like cattle to be worked to death. The Krupp Company soon became one of Europe's leading industrial combines. And it goes on to talk about the rehabilitation of many other Nazi industrialists, including bankers like Hermann Abs and others. And skipping down into this article, it talks about IG Farben. During the war, the company had financed Ludwig Erhard's research. After the war, 24 IG Farben executives were indicted for war crimes over Auschwitz III, but only 12 of the 24 were found guilty and sentenced to prison terms ranging from 1.5 to 8 years. IG Farben got away with mass murder. Nazi banker Abs of the Deutsche Bank was put in charge of allocating Marshall Fund aid reconstruction funds to German industry, and by 1948, he was effectively managing Germany's economic recovery. Crucially, Abs was also a member of the European League for Economic Cooperation, an elite intellectual pressure group set up in 1946. The League was dedicated to the establishment of a common market, the precursor of the European Union. Its members included industrialists and financiers, and it developed policies that are strikingly familiar today on monetary integration and common transport, energy, and welfare systems. When Konrad Adenauer, the first chancellor of West Germany, took power in 1949, Abs was his most important financial advisor. And skipping down. Like Abs, Ludwig Erhard flourished in post-war Germany. Adenauer made Erhard Germany's first post-war economics minister. In 1963, Erhard, protege of SS officer and war criminal Otto Ollendorf, succeeded Adenauer as chancellor for 3 years. But the German economic miracle, so vital to the idea of a new Europe, was built on mass murder. Skipping down again. Next month, 27 European Union member states vote in the biggest transnational election in history. Europe now enjoys peace and stability. Germany is a democracy, once again home to a substantial Jewish community. The Holocaust is seared into national memory. But the Red House report is a bridge from a sunny present to a dark past. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, once said, "In 50 years' time, nobody will think of nation-states." Unquote. For now, the nation-state endures, but these three typewritten pages are a reminder that today's drive towards a European federal state is inexorably tangled up with the plans of the SS and German industrialists for a Fourth Reich, an economic rather than a military imperium, or, as it was put in Serpent's Walk, a corporocracy. And so stay tuned as we see if America does indeed break up. We said that what's good for General Motors is good for America. GM's breaking up. What do you think? This concludes For the Record program number 676, Sedition Part 2, Target America. This is being recorded on June 14th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.